briefly introduce the Smiths and then turn it over to them. So for those who, you'll hear this again in the sermon service, but I met the Newtons, which Naomi's maiden name is Newton, when I was probably 5 years old, because her parents were missionaries from our church, so they would come back on furlough to our church and got to know their family, and then eventually they moved to San Antonio, got to know their family even better when they lived in San Antonio. Then met Joshua in high school when he was dating Naomi, and I believe was interning at the church for summer. And then they have, since that time, married, gone to seminary, served in Spain for 8 years, and are now in their 7th year of being in Mexico City. So they're friends and missionaries that we're very excited that they could come up here. They're in the U.S. for a year for lots of reasons, but I'll turn it over to them. I'm going to open with a question for them that they can answer. I have lots of questions that I can guide us, but if you have questions you'd like to ask them, feel free to jump in as well. But maybe as I turn it over, if you could just share a little more autobiographical details and your calling into ministry. And then you can come up here.
Well, thanks for having us. And I asked Jeremy if we could maybe do a Q&A so you don't have to hear me speak twice as a monologue. And I also think you guys are at a really significant place as a church where you're at right now. Location, size, everything. And I'm kind of excited to see what God's going to do through you guys in the coming years. I guess biographically, that's what you asked, right? A little background. So I grew up in California, the Central Valley in Bakersfield. And I grew up in a Christian family. Maybe some of you, if you're here. And I grew up with a lot of knowledge about Jesus. And I was a really, really good Pharisee. So I won like the Awana Kid of the Year Award when I was in Awana. You guys know what Awana is? Yeah, I memorized more passages than anybody else in the entire church. Yeah, I knew more than the Apostle Paul. And and so I knew all the right stuff, and I was even like the Christian kid, but I didn't quite fit in. But my identity was kind of lost. I didn't know who I was. I was one of the kids who went through puberty when I was like 11, and didn't know how to handle that, and I didn't fit in. And so when I went into high school, my freshman year, I finally began to connect with kids who were older than me and were interested in more deep, profound things, because I thought I was pretty smart. And that also led to a really sinful relationship that became an idol in my life. And when that relationship ended, I found myself in a deep depression, and I began thinking seriously about killing myself. And it was during that time of deep pain that one night I called out to God. And I didn't call out to him asking for forgiveness, to be honest. I called out to him and I asked him to kill me. And in his kindness, God chose to reinterpret that cry as a cry for help, and he saved me. And I had this pretty radical conversion where all that darkness and filth was just washed away, and this incredible, overwhelming love of Jesus filled my life and transformed how I began to live my life. So that knowledge that I was raised with pointed me to the right God, but it wasn't enough to actually transform my life. What I needed to do was actually come to know that living God and to trust him. And so I began to grow in him. I began to lead the worship band in my youth group that grew from 10 youth to 200. We saw this kind of movement of the Spirit. And then at the end of my high school years, my dad and my youth pastor began talking to me about maybe going into full-time ministry. After wrestling with that, I decided that's what I wanted to do. And it was while I was at the master's college many years ago, I was studying missions and apologetics. And I would actually lead a prayer group in the mornings once a week that would pray that the Lord would send out workers. Jesus says the fields are white for harvest, pray for workers. And so we'd pray that. And I tell people, don't pray that unless you're willing to at least go. And I didn't plan on being a missionary or anything. But one day I said that and my heart changed. And I knew that was me, that God was telling me to be the one to go. It was also during that time that I began to study church planting. There's a book by an old Anglican guy called Missionary Methods, St. Paul's or Ours, by Roland Allen. He was he's way ahead of his time, about 100 years ago. And he traced how church planting was at the heart of Paul's efforts in the book of Acts. And that began to awaken in me a desire to plant churches centered on the gospel that exists for the well-being of their communities around them. And that's really been my life since, is God further developing that passion and that heart for the local church throughout the world as God's plan to make himself known. That I met Naomi in college, and she fell in love with me. And we
very easy.
And we fell madly in love. And so when I was in seminary, we got married. She was actually still in college, finished seminary. And a month later, we moved to northern Spain, where we church planted for 8 years, not very successfully. And for the last 6 years, I've been leading a missionary team in Mexico City, where we're doing everything from church planting to addressing human trafficking, raising up pastors, training. I'll share a little bit more of that later on or the Q&A. But we want to see the gospel affect a city profoundly but broadly. And so Mexico City has 27 million inhabitants in the metropolitan area, so it's pretty big. How many people are in Wichita Falls?
104,000.
Yeah. That's kind of like my neighborhood is about 100,000. So make that bigger. So the question, how do you impact a city of 27 million people with the gospel in a way that matters? And our team, how we want to do that is by focusing on church planting, particularly through Mexican partners, through training leaders. Most Mexican leaders don't have much training. And I don't mean necessarily seminary training, but just they don't have much biblical training. So they don't really know how to unpack the Word of God and teach it. So we want to help them to do that. We want to focus on evangelism and discipleship, especially discipleship that happens when we all speak the truth and love to one another, not just a program, but actually a whole way of life. We do want to show the city that the gospel applies to all of life. So we want to help people in the area of like financial training, how to manage their finances. We have people on our team working specifically in the area of sex trafficking and prostitution, which is a major issue in our city, because the gospel speaks into those things. It's not just about how to get to heaven. It's about how to have a relationship with God that also then reconciles us to one another and provides hope to the world around us. So we actually shine as lights together in God's world, which is also a very broken world. And then we also want to do that through creating gospel partnerships. So we recognize that if we're going to see a significant movement of the gospel, you can't have a white American as the face of it in Mexico City. We need that to be happening through Mexican partners. It needs to be something driven by Mexicans primarily. So, and we don't want to do it on our own. So we want to come into the city, and we want to get to know people who share a similar vision and heart and passion for the gospel and for the city, and then begin to figure out how can we work together to do this better. So the church, we're not enemies. We're not competition. We are part of God's broader people, his broader church, and we need to serve one another if we're really going to have an impact. And I'd say the same for you guys in Wichita Falls. You may have multiple churches here, but if you are genuine, if there are churches that are following Jesus, then you're brothers and sisters. You're not enemies. And you have a shared responsibility to make Jesus known in Wichita Falls and beyond. So anyways, that's the brief version. Naomi, do you want to share anything else?
You covered it all. Bam.
I'll just say this about Naomi. Maybe this will come out in question and answer. But Naomi is especially impactful in terms of living out the gospel in like the normal, mundane work of life. So we oftentimes think of missionaries as like these superheroes who go off to other foreign lands and they do these amazing things. But most of mission life, and definitely for Naomi, is being a wife and mother in the place that God has placed us and doing it with gospel purposefulness. And if you talk to people we minister to, they'll have something nice to say about me, but most of them will have been most impacted by Naomi because the gospel is always on her tongue. And she shapes her life around the gospel, even as she's making dinner for our family or shopping in our neighborhood or picking our kids up from school. And that's really what we need. The world doesn't need a series of events. The world needs transformed people.
Well, I'll jump in and say that I think our time in Spain was particularly wonderful because our concept of, like, missionary evangelism was, like, so shattered because no one would engage us at all with any conversation, much less the gospel. And so, whereas previously we thought, well, present a winsome, logical, powerful presentation of the spoken gospel, and God will change hearts, and then no one would talk to us or listen to us. And so we had to, like, really rethink, okay, well, what's going on? How do we communicate the gospel in this context? I began to realize that my concept of the spoken gospel was extremely narrow. I thought that I could successfully share the gospel when I covered certain doctrinal points with someone. And so we started thinking about, okay, well, how does, if we truly love God and we are transformed by Him, then how does that need to be expressing itself, like, through every conversation, through the way I live my life? And so we began to push and experiment with that. And I did. I realized that this is the glory of the gospel, right? That it's not, it flows into and out of everything. It's not just a package, a clean package that we can only be applied in certain areas of our thinking and of our living. But that it really, really, the gospel impacts, like, creativity. It impacts how I cook and how I parent and how I choose to use my money and how I choose to use my time. And we began thinking about, like, actually being able to express then verbally how the gospel impacted those really common aspects of our lives. And we found that suddenly we were able to share really robust aspects of the gospel in ways that we hadn't previously thought of.
And when we first moved to Northern Spain, Spain as a whole has like 0.4% evangelical. It's very similar to many Muslim nations. The nation is primarily Catholic in name, but they don't actually believe anything. Mexico is different in how that looks, but that's what Spain was like. And in Northern Spain, where we lived, there was very little gospel presence. Most people had never met a Christian who wasn't Roman Catholic. And I imagined when I went to Spain that we'd have these, like, robust dialogues and engagements about the nature of the church and salvation by grace through faith and all these big things. What we didn't expect was to be completely and utterly ignored. They wouldn't talk with us at all. People in Northern Spain, they don't talk about God at all. It's inappropriate. It's literally inappropriate to talk about God among friends, and definitely among non-friends. So as I was ready to have these deep engagements with people and they were unwilling to engage me, we had to ask the question, how do you share the gospel with the people who won't listen? How do you share the gospel with the people who won't talk to you? And there was one specific passage that began to sort of upset my whole way of thinking. It's John 13:35. And Jesus says, all men will know that you're my disciples by your love for one another. If you have love for one another. And he's talking about Christians, how we love one another. And so one thing I realized was, the Christians in my neighborhood, I mean, the Spaniards in my neighborhood, when did they ever see me love other Christians? Because we partnered with another church in another side of the city. And I realized they never saw us love other Christians. But Jesus says that's how they're going to know we're his people, is actually by how we treat one another. So we began to think of the gospel in terms of, what does it look like to live the gospel in community, together, in daily life? And so in our neighborhood, people go for walks around this park every afternoon. So instead of just us walking around the park with them, we would invite another believing couple to do it with us. And suddenly they're getting a glimpse of how Christians relate to one another. It's this little extra element of just adding other believers as part of your daily life. If you have coffee at a specific location every week, invite another believer and a non-believer and just have coffee together. Adding that relational piece to it is actually part of God's plan. And then breaking down that distinction between the sacred and the secular, like Sunday mornings are sacred, but work is something less. You know, God is present when we're singing praise songs, but is God present when I'm bored at work on my computer? The answer is God's present in all those areas, and he's equally present in all those areas. There is no secular for the Christian. Everything is sacred. And so when we live all of life for the glory of God, and the gospel is on our tongues, just naturally, talk about this a little bit in the sermon later on, but when it's on our tongues because we just love Jesus, we talk about him, then our workplace becomes a place where we demonstrate the beauty and power of the gospel. our marriages become a place where we demonstrate the beauty and power of the gospel. How we deal with our kids when they have a fit in the grocery store demonstrates the beauty and power of the gospel. When I yell at my neighbor and curse at him and then have to go back and apologize, that shows the beauty and power of the gospel. And so instead of thinking of the gospel as this one-time event where I have like an hour to share the whole thing, living life intentionally and allowing the gospel to come out verbally in those little moments throughout the day and throughout your week. So maybe I can't share about the nature of the Trinity in that 30 seconds I have with my coworker, but maybe I can share something about the kindness of God or about integrity in that I refuse to make copies of this document because that would be violating a copyright law and I won't do it because I'm a Christian, or whatever it might be. And the way I describe it is when you're a little kid, you have those picture books that have numbers. I don't know if you remember those. Maybe I'm kind of getting old. But it has 1, 2, 3, 4, and you trace 1 to 2 and 2 to 3 and 3 to 4. And eventually you end up with a picture of like an elephant or a rhinoceros, and you're like amazed when you're 5. It's like that with the gospel. So in one conversation, we create this little dot here. Another conversation, I share something else about how the gospel affects life, and that's a dot over here. I remember Naomi once was talking with some Spanish woman in the park about parenting, and Naomi says, yeah, it's interesting, I was reading Proverbs this morning, and it said this about parenting, and that was weird for them, but not weird for her, because she literally had read Proverbs that morning, and it did say that. So that's another little dot, and the idea is, when you fill your life with the gospel, then these little gospel moments, maybe one word, maybe 30 seconds, and maybe a five-minute conversation, maybe a two-hour conversation, but you're filling your life with these gospel dots, and then the Holy Spirit, when he chooses to, at the right time and the right way, he connects those dots. And suddenly what you're giving people is not this little glimpse of the gospel. You're giving them this very fully developed vision of what the gospel really is. And then they have a much more informed ability, humanly speaking, to embrace that gospel or to reject the gospel. But that's between them and God ultimately. So that's really what shapes a lot of our life, is trying to live the gospel in all of life, daily life. So the difference between a missionary and an average church member isn't all that different. The real difference is we cross geographic barriers that you don't. But we are all sent ones by Jesus. And that's what an apostle means, is a sent one. I think in the Great Commission, we're all sent to wherever we are to make him known. And that means that as how we think of mission in Mexico City isn't so different than how you need to be thinking of mission in Wichita Falls. How do I fill my life with the gospel? How do we interact with our neighbors and community to provide opportunity to interact with one another about the gospel? And then how do we do it together? Because God doesn't call us to make him known just as individuals. The church isn't like this byproduct, like this secondary thing. God's plan from Genesis 1 till the end is to create a people for himself. And that's a whole other sermon. But it's very easily traced. He created Adam and Eve in his image, and he called them to fill the world with human beings, also created in his image, and therefore turning the world into this ball of his glory, reflecting his image to the universe. And they failed to do that. And then he called Noah and his family to do something similar, and they failed to do that. And then he calls Abraham to create a family that would be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation to reflect his glory to the world. And they failed to do that. And so he sent a son to make all things right. And the fruit of that in the present is created. He has created a people for himself, which is the church, and specifically the local church. And our job is to be salt and light in a broken world and together reflect his glory to the world around us. It's always been his purpose. And so as Americans, we tend to be very individualistic. Mexicans also actually are very individualistic outside of their immediate family. And we think of faith as like, it's God in me. But it's actually God in us. That's always been how he's wanted to function. It's God relating to his people and us as his people relating to him. And so right now, you guys, on a Sunday morning, you have, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 people. That is the group that God wants right now to reflect his glory in Wichita Falls. And so your job is to figure out how do you do that together.
Q&A.
Now Q&A.
Bam. Let's do this.
Well, I'm going to pass out this later, but Naomi, you wrote a blog a couple years ago about calling, as you were kind of wrestling with, felt called here, and now we're here. Uh-huh. Can you just kind of kind of share some of that. What started the blog? What kind of general overview? The idea of calling, what that means, what it looks like.
Yeah. I suspect most of you here have heard talk of the calling. Like, it's not like the calling, it's the calling. You know, it's like this good holy thing that, are you called to be a missionary? Or are you called to be a pastor? And so, I was talking to a woman a few years ago, and she was asking me a little bit more about, like, the calling, and I ended up writing this blog post, which, and I'll give you a verbal summary, but I think it's been interesting throughout my life. I would say when I was 15, I was called into ministry, maybe. I came to a point in my life in which I came to the Lord, I really think, at a young age, probably 5, 6. I think there was a legitimate response on my part to follow Jesus. But then it was like more when I was in high school, I started taking it more seriously and recognized, oh, like God loved me to this extent that he gave his life, and I really was beginning to understand the magnitude of that, and I wanted to respond in a way that was adequate. And I thought, well, what should I do, because I love him so much? I know, I'll become a missionary, which is a funny thing. I don't, for some reason, that was the pinnacle of love, right? I love God, I'll be a missionary. And I wouldn't necessarily say that to this day, but at that point at 15, I was like, yes, I'm called to be a missionary. I'm going to go be a missionary. Went to college, became, studied, biology to become I wanted to go to medical school, serve the Lord, as a medical, doctor, and use that as a venue to share the gospel. And then I was called to medical missions, right? And then I went to college and began to study a little bit more church planting. I met Joshua. We started having these conversations about what was the role of the church in missions. Like, shook up my, like, thinking about really what was, what the role of the church was in missions, and I think God turned my heart towards that, and also towards Joshua. And so then I was like, whoa, I thought I was supposed to call to be a medical missionary, but like, what if Joshua's not doing that? And we were called to Spain, and then called away from Spain. And there have been times, I think, calling is a hard word, because it implies like a really like clear direction from the Lord. And in all of these things, like there have been nudgings from the Lord, but no like clear loud voices, and so in fact, when we went to Mexico. We were trying to choose what we were praying about. Where should we go next? Should we go? Should we church plant in LA area? Should we go to Mexico City? And we prayed, we fasted, we called the church to pray and fast with us. And we really wanted to go where the Lord called, and really didn't really hear a clear answer. And we had to just like make a choice, decide. All right, we'll go to Mexico. And I think all that to say, the more I do this, the more I follow Jesus, I think the specifics of like of his calling on my life are not so clear. Like, was I really called? Was I called to missions? Was I called to medical missions? Was I called to Spain? And in one sense, I could say that God directed my paths all along the way. But what is clearer to me is God's loud call on my life to love him and to love whoever's right in front of me. To love him and love my neighbor. And that is clear. And so I think that maybe in terms of the missionary call, that's not as loud and clear on my life or on everyone's life. But I'll follow him. Like if I think it's supposed to be Mexico City, I'll go. But I think what's clear for me, and then also what I know he's calling me to love him and love my neighbor, and I know he's calling you to love him and to love your neighbor. And so I think that is something that we can, as brothers and sisters, like we can legitimately say, well, like, yeah, you're called to do that, but like let's do it together, let's do it better. I don't know if that is a good summary, but I say it better in the blog post. You should read it.
What are some of the perhaps biggest obstructions right now in Mexico City to the gospel?
Yeah, the biggest the challenges for the gospel in Mexico City, there are a few. One is actually the opposite of Spain. Spain was a very non-spiritual culture. People didn't think about God. It wasn't a part of their lives. They might attend Mass on Easter and Christmas, but that was it. Mexico is a very spiritual culture. It's a very spiritual people. It's sort of like you leave the window open, anything comes in, anything goes out. So they're spiritual without a concrete sense of commitment to Jesus. And that allows people to think that they're kind of okay because they're spiritually engaged in some vague way. But God doesn't call us to some vague spirituality. He calls us to Jesus. And they don't have that. In our neighborhood specifically, actually, there are fewer Catholic churches. Anything traditional, there's actually a lot of esoteric stuff. We have a coffee shop a block from our apartment called, in English, Witchcraft and Willow. So you can have your palm read while you have your coffee. So you have active witchcraft, you have a shaman down the street from us. We have the two primary Buddhist centers in Mexico are on our street. So you have this spirituality without commitment and a spirituality without the lordship of Jesus. I'd say that'd be the greatest obstruction. Then you also have a spirituality that's tied to tradition. That's very similar to Spain. In Spain, people are Catholic because they're Spanish and they're only Catholic. But they won't talk about anything. So it's part of their identity. And to not be Catholic would to cease to be Spaniard in their way of thinking. In a similar way, in Mexico, there's a bit of Catholicism in that, but even before that, so like the Day of the Dead, we were just talking about, Jeremy and I were talking about that. The Day of the Dead in Mexico is a day where they put out altars and they put food out of those who have died and family members. And then they actually believe that the spirits of the dead come back and take the flavor out of the food, and you commune with them. It's not like Halloween in the States. It's very different. People still believe that. In the States, they try to talk about it like just a cultural fun event like Coco or some other movie, Something of Life that came out. What's it called? You told
Book.
The Book of Life, yeah, or about the Day of the Dead. It's sort of a fun Disney way. But people actually still believe that that's what happens. Many people do. And we had a woman who we love very deeply who actually made a commitment to Christ. And she's going to get baptized, and the next weekend she went home to visit her family who are not believers, and it was the Day of the Dead, and she made a conscious choice to not follow Jesus. She changed her mind, and she embraced the traditions of her ancestors and the Day of the Dead instead of following Jesus. That was the dividing marker. Now, do you have to stop being Mexican to be a follower of Jesus? Obviously not. You follow Jesus as a Mexican. You follow Jesus as an American. Now, Mexican or American is not your primary identity any longer. It becomes less important because Christ is what's most important and the family of God is more important. But in her mind, the Day of the Dead so represented her ancient tradition that to give that up would be to lose her identity. And in one way, she was incorrect, but in another way, she was correct. Because again, where do we find our primary identity? It's not the American flag. It's not the Mexican flag. It's not the glories of Mexico past and the Mexica Empire. It's not your job. Our identity is that we're created in God's image and uniquely loved in him, and that has to take place of priority. Another challenge in Mexico City is Mexico is not so much an area where there's a huge amount of racism like you see in the States, but you do have a classism. So you have kind of upper middle class, lower class, and then things in between. And the lower class especially can't really rise up and become middle or upper class very easily. You're pretty much just, you're semi-trapped in your location. But joined with that is the desire to look good. So people might live in a terrible little apartment that's run down, but if they have the car, they want a nice car because they want to look good. They might not have a lot of clothes, but they want to dress well, at least in our area of Mexico City. And so that idea, that desire for status and class and recognition is fundamentally at odds with the gospel, which calls us to humility in how we live. And so I think that can get in the way of people willing, being willing to humble themselves and follow Jesus.
I speak into this, but I wonder if one of the biggest hindrances is an untransformed church.
Yeah.
And so really there is a mentality that you can be a Christian and show up at church on Sunday, like be an evangelical Christian, which 20 years ago, when my parents were missionaries in Mexico 30 years ago, like evangelical Christians were being actively persecuted. They were, and it was a significant step to say that you were an evangelical Christian and not a Catholic. And yet, so within the past 30 years, there's been more freedom. There's been religious freedom. It's now not as scandalous to say that you're an evangelical Christian. And yet, the evangelical church has lost maybe its clear passion for Jesus. It's just, in one sense, for many people, it's just replaced their religion. So instead of Catholic, now Christian. But that means very little in terms of a transformed life.
Yeah, it's interesting. So in the past 30 years, you've seen a movement of the gospel throughout Latin America, and there is a genuine movement. You did not have nearly as many Christians and churches in Latin America 30 years ago. But at least in Mexico, and I suspect in many places in Latin America, very quickly that growing Christianity has become a cultural Christianity very similar to the United States, where people are Christian in name, but they are not transformed by the gospel. And if you're not transformed by the gospel, then you probably don't know Jesus, because that's what he does. he does it at different speeds sometimes, but that's what he does. He always brings transformation. And so in Mexico, there's a recent study, I'm trying to remember the exact numbers, but something like 9% of the population self-identifies as evangelical Protestant Christian. But roughly half of those same people self-identify as non-practicing. So half of the evangelical population identifies itself as non-practicing. So that means they're Christian in name, but don't actually do anything with it. If you go to the city, there's probably a smaller number of believers in the city. We would estimate 3 to 5% would be genuine followers of Jesus. But there are plenty of churches and people that we know who are kind of Christians in name, but not much else. So they're a minority, but a minority that's already lost its power. Added to that, you have cultural issues in Mexico. There are a lot of power issues in Mexico. It's tied to their history. You have these controlling, powerful figures, and that happens in the church. The pastor becomes a sort of a mini pope, and they're very controlling, and they don't exist to equip the saints for work of ministry. And so they may have large or small ministries, but they can only be as large or as small as the pastor can handle. And they can view other churches and leaders as threats to them. And that's also very cultural in Mexico City. There's a huge amount of mistrust, desconfianza, among people. Partly that's because people are oftentimes trying to use you. They've been ripped off enough times where people have built a wall around themselves, and there's mistrust. And there's mistrust among churches as well. That element of the culture comes into the church. And then you have legalism. Very quickly has taken over the church. So you have prosperity gospel on one side, which is true throughout Latin America, where the gospel is about getting rich, and that's very present in Mexico. But you also have a more conservative Christianity that's about rules, and maybe even more than rules, it's about a facade of righteousness. You have to look good. There is very little grace in most churches that we interact with as we talk with people. And I don't mean that to just throw them under the bus. There are some really wonderful, amazing churches and people. But the pattern seems to be that you can never admit that you're really dealing with sin. And church leaders would never confess sin. Now, that's oftentimes true in the States as well. The problem is, if your church leaders never sin, then they don't need Jesus either. And if you can't confess your sin without being received with grace and pointed back to Jesus, then you're left with the facade of righteousness. You look good on the outside because you don't dare expose yourself. So one thing that we try to do in our, I didn't mention this earlier, we planted a church in the city center that I pastor with a Mexican brother. And one of the things we're trying to develop is a culture of truth and grace in which everyone speaks the truth and love to one another. That's how we grow. That's Ephesians 4. Not just the pastor. Everyone speaks the truth and love to one another. And we can be honest about our failures without like just celebrating our failures. Oh yeah, we're the church that struggles with alcohol abuse. You know, no, that's not like that. We're the church that struggles with pornography. Yeah. No, it's saying that we are a broken people who are finding healing and redemption and transformation in Jesus. And we're going to be honest about us being broken, including our leadership. And together, we're going to follow Jesus. And grace is going to be made real in our lives as we do that. And so it's interesting, one of our little church plant, which is actually similar in size to your guys' church. We started with 10, 12 people a few years ago, and we're 30, 40, 50, kind of depending these days. Somehow come out of Christian backgrounds that was very Pharisaical, and now they're starting to figure out how to be honest about their brokenness and then find hope through the gospel in light of it. Our natural tendency is to fall back into a legalism, a Pharisaism. It's safer. It doesn't cause us to be exposed. But the gospel exposes us. And if we're willing to be exposed, then we find hope. If we're unwilling to be exposed, then we will hide in our sin, and it'll eat us up from the inside out. And I think that's a lot of what's happened in the church.
And I think on the ground, what that's looked like is lots and lots of time spent together with each other.
Yeah.
So if you want truth and grace, there is that you have to spend time together, because it's just. People can't really see my need. I'm real good, guys. Like, I grew up in the church, and I have lots of self-control, and I'm real good at keeping my act together for, like, 2 or 3 hours. But it's when people spend extended amounts of time with me, then my sins start coming out. And it is in those moments that someone can, who genuinely knows who I am, and genuinely can see both my strengths and my weaknesses, and and then, since we're spending time together, we have the relationship foundation to where someone can, a friend can just really tenderly, be upfront about the sins they see in my life, and my heart is willing to receive that, and then that's where transformation comes. But I do sometimes wonder if the greatest fruit of our ministry has come from just eating dinner with people, like meal after meal after meal after meal. And yes, we do Bible studies, and we're for Bible studies. And yes, we do pastor training, and we're for pastor training. And we do that's all good. But it's our dinners together in which the gospel is woven through our conversations. I think that's what God has been faithful to use that in a significant way.
Yeah. And we need, our church plant in Mexico City, we need them. I need them to grow. Mm-hmm. I need them to speak the truth and love to me. I'm not just a giver. I'm a really broken guy. And I have deep tendencies towards sin. And I'm not capable of handling it alone. It's not just me and Jesus. Jesus gave me his people, and I need them. And so we have to also communicate our need for them. And we need to equip the saints so they can actually speak the truth and love to us. And that's where the Bible is at the center.
Yeah.
Is if we are being equipped to speak truth and love with the Bible in our hands and the gospel in our tongue, then in every moment of life is an opportunity to remind people of the glory of Jesus, of the power of grace, of the call to righteousness. For you guys, Jeremy's been here a year and a half or so, right? He needs you guys to speak the truth and love to him. And that doesn't mean, look for his flaws and criticize him all the time. There's always one or two of those people who can always find the little cracks in your armor. It's a genuine commitment and love to him to help him grow as a man of God and his family. And he needs to have the same commitment to you guys, and you need to have that commitment to each other. And that time piece is important because if church is just the gathering on Sunday mornings, and you're not a family. You're like a weekly club, or a weekly class. I don't know. Families spend time together. And if non-believers are going to see our love for one another, then you actually have to spend time with one another and do it in public settings at times. It can be simple stuff like, if you like coffee, like regularly go to the same coffee shop and hang out with believers and non-believers and just be present and love one another. Go out to eat after church on Sundays and be present in the community and do it together. When you have a need, instead of hiding it, like tell someone you have a need and ask them to help you. Humble yourself and actually depend upon other people. It's not rocket science. It doesn't take some like master plan, this great strategy. It requires a shared commitment to each other, to your city, and to your God.
Did you guys have any trouble going from the Spanish to the Mexican Spanish?
Mainly the culture. I mean, the difference between Spain Spanish and Mexican Spanish is like British English and American English. So definitely there are some issues like there's a word that kids use for the rear end. I'll say that to not cause any problems with anybody. That in Spain, it's a word for little kids. And in Mexico, it's like a pretty harsh swear word. So we found that out when roughly the same time period, Malachi got sent to his principal's office and me and Naomi got rebuked by a married couple. So there are things like that. And I had to learn how to speak in usted, the y'all form in Mexico that's different in Spain.
Well, I remember Malachi having problems with that in school too, because he was speaking informally to his school teachers, which is what you do in Spain. But in Mexico, no, you speak formally to your school teacher, and you use the usted.
Yeah.
Well, I know in Spain, they have the seta, and so you probably they thought you had a lisp or something. Maybe.
Well, I'll say this to defend my Spanish brothers and sisters. Is in Spain they use a th sound for the z and the soft c. It's not a lisp, but a lisp is always with an S. Just throwing it out there, it's not a lisp. But in Spain, yeah, the Z and the soft C are a TH sound.
Well,
but
The whole story behind that was the king had a lisp, and that's the reason why they changed it.
Which is actually just a legend that's not true.
It's not true.
But I heard that
but,
too.
But we've heard the same thing.
We've heard the same thing.
Just defending my Spanish brethren, like, that's not true.
No, mostly actually, Mexicans are fun. They just thought we were Spanish, and they thought we were right.
See, I lived in Madrid for a while. Okay. I was a missionary teacher at a school there, and we had several churches there, and I think people there, maybe in Madrid, were a little bit more open to the gospel than maybe in the north of Spain. But they have several churches there.
Yeah, definitely. Madrid and Barcelona would have more of a gospel presence because they're more metropolitan, and so there are more ideas that kind of flow in and out versus Pamplona, where we were, was the capital of its state, but no one moves to Pamplona, no one leaves Pamplona. So you have a very village-like mentality in some sense. Although, even in Madrid and Barcelona, there percentage-wise, there are very, very few believers, but definitely a lot more.
Yeah. With two of your sons here, what do they like best about Mexico City?
Josu, do you want to start?
Sure. Probably Matt would say this too, but their food.
Oh, yeah?
Their food.
Oh, man. Food's amazing.
Way different than what we think of as Mexican food.
Yes.
We enjoy good Tex-Mex. It's just not Mexican.
One of our favorite taco stands has like two corn tortillas and with like a thin slice of beef that they chop up, and then on top of that, they put French fries. And it's amazing.
And cactus,
but this is one with the cactus.
Cactus?
Yeah.
No, without the prickly.
Without
the
prickly.
Good call.
Malachi, what do you enjoy about Mexico?
Well, first of all, I'm going to say part of what my brother said, Taco Bell's heresy, just letting y'all know.
So, not cool, Taco Bell.
Mexican food. Taco Bell's kind of... Yeah, no. At any rate, something that I kind of appreciate about Mexico, I mean, there's lots of things. I'm just trying to find something that doesn't sound really cliche. Something that I can really appreciate from Mexico is the people. They may not they may not be the most, they may not keep everything they say commitment-wise all the time, but they're really friendly and they're really open. I also love that I can invite somebody at 3 and they'll come at 4 and they'll stay the rest of the day because it gets me out of doing my homework. But
I'm on to you.
They're, dang it. at any rate, my I struggle making friends. And I'm a very extroverted person. You can probably tell that by now. But at any rate, I'm me and my siblings are kind of fated to, you know, not completely fit in anywhere. We get the bonus of, you know, knowing Spanish and English, but we're different in many cases, and that's something we struggle with. So it's good to have people who, though they consider us slightly strange, and think that because we're gingers, we're even more strange. They're still friendly, and once you understand that when they're insulting you, it's usually just, you know, it's like the chilling with the bros. It's pretty okay.
So one kind of fun thing in Mexico that our kids don't necessarily love, but it's kind of fun to watch, is we learned after moving there by watching people that redheads are good luck in Mexico. So if you walk behind us and you watch people, they'll pinch each other. Because when you see a redhead, you pinch someone, and it's good luck.
And you get a wish.
You don't pinch the redhead.
You don't pinch the redhead.
We're immune.
I'm glad that you explained that, because I have a redheaded son, and I did not know this. And somebody said something, go to a capoeira in town, and they don't speak English. And they do it every time.
Huh?
They start, and they point at our family, and I had no idea. Why is this happening?
There you go. It's bring them joy. So, literally, wherever you go with Mexicans, you bring good luck and joy.
We're not bringing our son unless you.
We have about 10 minutes left. Any other questions about color of hair and how it can get you
better? So, the boys are going to
school
in Mexico?
So, we've done a few different things, but for the last few years, 3 kids who were school age went to Mexican public school in our neighborhood. And then when Malachi got to junior high, the system doesn't work. It breaks down pretty well. Educational system doesn't work very well from junior high on in Mexico. So we're still looking for the right option for him. He did an online school last year. And next year he'll enter into what's high school in Mexico. It's a little bit later than high school here. And we're still figuring out. It'll probably be a private school or an online school or something like that.
Are the graduation rates for these high schools and junior high schools really bad? Is that why they're considered...
I'm not sure graduation rates. High school in Mexico is a little more like high school used to be in the States maybe 30 or 40 years ago, where your goal was to finish high school. And now oftentimes in the States, it's expected that you'll go to college. In Mexico, it's still, I think, an achievement to finish high school. So it definitely is different than many places in the States. I think the system breaks down. And there's a lack of funding. There's a lack of training. There's overcrowding in the schools. The average Mexican, at least Mexico City, even a poor Mexican, will spend half their income to send their kids to private school, if possible. So also you have kind of a brain drain from the public school system because everyone's left. And those who are within lack the finances or an education to get out of the system. That's definitely, I mean, I'm not sure all the reasons, but that's definitely a piece of it.
And I think I think junior high and high school is hard for Mexico. I mean, I think the system is breaking down even for a Mexican. But I think we're an added we have an added challenge in that we have kids that are very outside of what they know of. And so, I mean, I think the United States. I mean, we're a nation of immigrants And sometimes I think we forget that. But as a whole, I think that even within the education system, there is an understanding that if a kid comes from a different background, there are cultural reasons why they're not learning in the same way. I think there's broader awareness to immigration issues. And Mexico has very, very little immigration. Like, very few people immigrate to Mexico. And so they aren't forced to wrestle with, what does it look like to have a kid who doesn't think like we do? And so I think that was one of the issues that we faced with Malachi. Some of the times when he was just thinking differently. He was pegged as a wild child or a troublemaker or maybe an idiot. But
when you think of pretty much everyone, particularly in high school and beyond, who's in the public system, they will be from the same socioeconomic background, very similar culturally. And then you stick one of our kids in that system, and they're just not going to fit in. And if the teachers always teach the same sorts of students with similar backgrounds, you bring one kid in from a different background, and they just don't know what to do with them. They can't tell the difference between a cultural difference and like a mental issue or a rebellion issue. And so that was really, really challenging.
And I think, I mean, as much as, and I, like my kids are really, really fantastic about adapting and figuring out like that whole like third culture kid issue where they can kind of scope out a situation and adjust to very upper class people and adjust to very lower class people, but at the same time they are still very much children. And I think even that skill set has I saw keenly the limitations that skill set has limitations within these settings.
Now I will say though, this year we're spending the year in San Antonio before going back this summer to Mexico City, and Josu and Selma, who are in fifth and sixth grade, they went straight from Mexican public school to one of the top school districts in San Antonio, and they've done super well. So they weren't behind academically.
Right.
So the school system, I mean, it worked out well for them academically. In fact, Selma basically skipped fourth grade and was able to go into fifth grade, even though she's too young for it here in the States. So it worked for us educationally at that level. It was more once you get beyond the elementary school level, the teaching wasn't working out for our family, and there's some safety issues and things. That is one of our primary concerns going back, is how to take care of our kids in that area. And a lot of missionaries leave the field once their kids hit that age because they can't find good options. The private school options, there's lots of private schools, but they can cost anywhere from $300 a month to one school costs $20,000 a year, U.S. dollars. Homeschooling doesn't exist in Mexico for the most part. They have something called homeschooling, but it's really just ACE, if you're familiar with that, which is not really homeschooling in as Americans think of it. So there isn't a homeschooling community.
And it's an option for us.
Yeah.
It just means, and we have to be extremely proactive in terms of finding other ways for our kids to engage in local culture. Right. And it's been surprisingly difficult. We tried it for a couple of years, and we were surprised at how difficult it was.
Yeah,
because you don't have a homeschool group like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Here you have co-ops and whole communities of people, and in Mexico it'd be us. And our kids already, they can't really leave our apartment by themselves because of security issues. And so we live in a 1,000-square-foot apartment, and they're trapped there all day. And you add schooling is in that apartment as well, and they kind of suck the soul out of you after a while.
I don't have a soul.
Maybe those 2 years of homeschooling did you in.
All right, we're going to wrap up.
Yeah.
You want to close with prayer?
Sure. Before I pray, I will say, Bill and I were roommates our last year of college. And it's Bill Clifton, and we had not seen each other since our wedding almost 19 years ago, so it's kind of fun that he's here.
He survived.
Father, thank you for this group of people. We ask, God, that you will help them to recognize the gifts and talents and passions that you've given them individually and together, and help them to see how they might live purposefully for your glory and for the good of this city. And we thank you, Father, that we get to serve you in different locations. We have the same gospel, the same God. We offer the same hope. In Jesus' name, amen. Mm-hmm.